The World is supported by Israel Story, a podcast that tells extraordinary stories about regular people living in Israel, the kind you won't see on the news or online. The show kicked off season 4 with a miniseries called The Wall, beginning with the gorgeous tale of a Jewish Arab baby born at the Western Wall in the middle of the Six-Day War. Hosted by Mishy Harman and brought to you by Tablet Magazine and PRX. Subscribe to Israel Story on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, israelstory.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Support comes from Germany, celebrating the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Germany will never forget America's steadfast support through difficult times. From the Marshall Plan to the Berlin Airlift to the 2+4 negotiations that led to German reunification, the fall of the wall turned Germany into the happiest nation on earth. Thank you, America. Connect with us on social media at Germany in USA.
In Iran, gas prices spiked, people protested, and the government has now shut down the internet.
For the Iranian government to shut down the internet right now is done to prevent coordination or prevent the outside world from seeing what's happening. Governments, when there's less eyes on them, they're more inclined to repress.
Also today, the White House has plenty of lawyers, but Rudy Giuliani is the president's main man.
By really almost setting up an office at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, he made it very clear that you could get to Trump through him.
How did Giuliani get entangled in U.S. foreign policy? And a furry face in Washington packs his bags for China.
We have been preparing for this since the moment that he was born.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you here this Monday. Iranians are the latest group lashing back at their government through demonstrations. Since Friday, protesters have filled the streets of the capital, Tehran, and at least 80 other cities and towns across Iran. The protesters have blocked roads, clashed with police, and burned over 100 banks. One young woman spoke with her colleagues at the BBC's Persian service.
In the past 3 nights, here looks like a war zone. An 18-year-old boy was shot dead. Our friends captured 5 motorbikes and a car from the security forces and set them on fire. Last night, we captured another car and 8 more motorbikes of the militias. Our friends are resisting and have not given up. The officials don't care about our demands. They are rounding up young people and taking them to prison.
That woman would not let us use her name out of concern for her safety. The Iranian authorities today confirmed at least 2 deaths and 1,000 arrests. Despite all that, Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei dismissed the protesters as hooligans and described what's happening in the streets as not the actions of normal people. The protests began after the government announced plans to slash subsidies on gasoline, causing prices to jump 50%. The Iranian government is reeling from a massive drop in revenues caused mainly by U.S. sanctions preventing Iran from selling its oil. So the Revolutionary Guard militia has been quick to accuse the U.S. of instigating the unrest and has warned that it will crack down hard on the protesters if necessary. In the meantime, one of Tehran's responses has been to shut down the internet. The World's Shirin Jafari looks at why.
Email, Instagram, social media, and messaging apps, they're all blocked in Iran. This is what people hear when they try to make an internet call on, say, WhatsApp. The voice says access to the internet outside of Iran is not possible at this time due to an order from the state. Iranians outside of the country are also cut off from calling their loved ones.
All of my family are living in Iran, so I was not able to talk to them. I'm totally disconnected. I have no idea what's going on.
Amir Rashidi is an internet security expert at the Center for Human Rights in Iran. It's an NGO based in New York. He says the internet shutdown started on Friday when protesters poured into the streets. On Saturday morning, internet access was spotty, and by lunchtime, it was completely shut down. Rashidi says it's clear why the government is doing this.
When you see what kind of messaging app is blocked, like what kind of application is blocked, I think we can have this conclusion that the main purpose is to blocking the way that Iranian inside and outside they are communicating together, and they don't want any news come from Iran.
And this is what the Iranian leaders don't want the outside world to see. Videos showing anti-government protesters and the violent response from security forces. This one is among the very few videos that have trickled out of Iran. Pouya Ali Maram teaches Middle Eastern studies at MIT. He's writing a book about the protest movement that erupted in Iran in 2009.
For the Iranian government to shut down the internet right now is done to prevent coordination or prevent the outside world from seeing what's happening. Governments, when there's less eyes on them, they're more inclined to repress.
Ali Maram says cutting internet connectivity might seem like a good tactic for the government, but it might backfire. He says fewer people online could mean more people on the streets. There are really two internets in Iran, says Mahsa Ali Mardani, a PhD candidate at Oxford University. One is national, set up and operated by the state. The other is global. Ali Mardani says the Iranian government has been preparing for this moment for a long time.
The general trend over the past 10 years since 2009 has been to really try to institutionally try to restrict the internet space and find ways to quickly and swiftly shut it down without really shutting down the nation's infrastructure.
That's why Iranians can't call their families on WhatsApp right now. But Ali Mardani says they are able to do things like online banking on Iran's national internet system. Alp Toker heads a group called NetBlocks. It's a civil society organization that tracks global internet outage in real time. He says it took the Iranian government 24 hours to completely shut off global internet access.
This is unprecedented in recent times, and it's a very extreme measure. And it's obviously also happened somewhat unexpectedly, just judging by the response that it has taken some time to bring these networks down.
And Toker says the results for citizens in Iran is more than a simple inconvenience. The government is silencing its people.
It's got very serious human rights implications. It's a security issue. It's a safety issue. And Iran should look to bring back its internet as soon as possible.
The Trump administration has condemned Iran's response to the protests. "Let them speak," tweeted the State Department spokeswoman over the weekend. But researcher Mahsa Ali Mardani, who hasn't been able to connect with her family and friends in Iran, says U.S. sanctions are also part of the problem.
The sanctions the U.S. have placed on Iran has caused a lot of internet infrastructure from being blocked for Iranians. So huge portions of Google's infrastructure, Amazon's infrastructure, Apple's infrastructure have been blocked for Iranians. And so this has caused huge hurdles.
Researcher Amir Rashidi says the Iranian people are stuck between a global superpower and their own government.
On one side, we have to deal with sanctions, and other side in Iran, we have the government and the authority that they are blocking the internet.
And for now, he says, Iranians both inside and outside of the country have no other option but to keep refreshing those messaging and social media apps in the hope of getting back online. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
For several days, the campus of Hong Kong's prestigious Polytechnic University has been a field of battle. Students inside the campus versus the authorities trying to get them out. Police have pushed past barricades and fired tear gas, rubber bullets, and water cannons at students. Dozens of activists have been reported injured. The students have been fighting back with makeshift weapons. Joey Siu is a spokesperson for a coalition of student unions in Hong Kong. I spoke with her earlier today. What was it like for you last night, Joey? Were you able to keep in touch with the students barricaded inside the campus during the standoff?
It was a really disastrous night because at first we cannot get in touch with any of them. And the situation was very concerning because the police were actually equipping themselves with machine guns and live rounds. And they're basically surrounding the whole university campus.
So essentially, you were cut off from all of your fellow protesters and student colleagues who were inside the campus. Emotionally, was that hard, not knowing what was going on inside while you were barricaded outside?
It was really hard because the police are actually asking all the journalists inside the campus to leave. And that makes us very hard to know what is happening inside from news and from the Facebook lives. And because the resources inside the polytechnic universities are getting used up, and many of the students, their phones are out of battery and we cannot call them. And they could only report to us like every 2 hours that they are safe. We cannot confirm their safety up until now.
So just to bring us up to speed, Joey, how many friends do you have barricaded inside the campus? And what do you think's going to happen to this whole drama?
I have more than 10 friends right now that are still trapped in the Polytechnic University, and they have no way out from the campus right now. And I know that the charge that they are facing could lead to imprisonment for up to 10 years. I'm very worried because I don't know how the situation could go. They're already firing live rounds. They're actually trying to kill the students inside.
So as protesters are more and more willing to lay their life on the line, police are also getting injured in the process. I mean, they're bringing force, but students are throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails. One policeman got shot with a bow and arrow. What happened to the non-violent resistance of the demonstrators?
We try to be as peaceful as possible. But what I want to say is that the level of force used on the two sides are never equal. For example, like yesterday, the police had been gearing up with machine guns, gearing up themselves with live rounds, and they are even driving the armored vehicles, trying to crash over the students. The force that the police are using is way too high than the force that we are using to defend ourselves. And yes, and I think the world has to understand what is the actual situation in Hong Kong, that we have no choice but to protect ourselves.
Well, the nightmare scenario for many protesters, for many people watching this around the world, is that Beijing will bring the demonstrations to a violent end. And that in turn could prompt a much more draconian relationship between Hong Kong and the mainland. Do you feel the protests have been effective in preventing the kind of future that Hong Kongers really worry about?
Because of the protests, we have successfully stopped the extradition bill from passing through the Legislative Council. We're actually trying very hard to prevent Hong Kong from falling into becoming another mainland city. I mean, people in Hong Kong actually know that the Chinese Communist Party is actually encroaching Hong Kong in all aspects very slowly and bit by bit. So if we do not continue our fight today, I mean, Hong Kong will eventually fall. So I cannot say whether it is effective, but we have no choice and we have to continue the fight.
Joey Siu, a spokesperson for the Coalition of Student Unions in Hong Kong, speaking with us from Hong Kong. Joey, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Charlotte Bronte is best known for her classic novel, Jane Eyre, but the 19th century English writer started small, like really small. An auction in Paris today sold off a miniature manuscript that Bronte wrote in 1830 when she was 14 years old.
It's a tiny, tiny book the size of a matchbox, but, you know, special things sometimes come in small packages.
That's Kitty Wright. She heads up the Bronte Parsonage Museum in Yorkshire, England. The book is one of five that still exists. They measure barely 1 inch by 2 inches.
You know, these books are sort of packed with 4,000 tiny, tiny words, you know, really small.
The Bronte Society bought the itty-bitty manuscript for $860,000 today to give to the museum's collection. The museum already has the four other tiny books Charlotte Bronte wrote when she was a young teen.
Charlotte made them as magazines for her toy soldiers. So they are like miniature facsimile magazines. They have contents pages, they have stories, articles, and even little advertisements in the back. It's a really sort of early sign that she wanted to be a published writer.
The manuscript will join the four others like it at the Bronte Parsonage Museum, the house that Bronte grew up in, the house where she played with toy soldiers and wrote these stories. So no wonder the museum's director is ecstatic that the final remaining book is coming home. Wright says the writing was so small, no grown-ups could read it.
Probably just as well, because some of the contents might be deemed to be unsuitable for the daughter of a vicar to be writing at age 14.
One of the stories describes a murderer driven to madness after being haunted by his victims. An immense fire burns in his head, causing his bedroom curtains to catch fire too. If that scene sounds familiar, you might remember something similar happening in Jane Eyre, which Bronte would publish 17 years later in a normal font size. You're listening to The World. A quick note before we get back to the show. We're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we have the opportunity to receive $20,000 in matching funds to support our reporting. That means more support for our unparalleled coverage of issues like immigration, the environment, women's empowerment, human rights. Make a contribution today to support the global journalism you rely on. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. How times change. In the 1970s, a recording device brought down a president. Today, we're looking at the records of cell phone conversations. In the impeachment inquiry last week, a potential bombshell was dropped. In addition to the suspicious July 25th phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's president, there was another phone call between the president and Gordon Sondland, his ambassador to the European Union, who was on his cell phone in a restaurant in Kyiv, on a potentially unsecured phone line. That news stunned some security experts, including Larry Pfeiffer. He served 32 years in the U.S. intelligence community, including as senior director of the White House Situation Room.
I'm going to assume that the Russian intelligence service and perhaps other foreign intelligence services are targeting guys like Ambassador Sondland. If you're a high-value target for Russia, you just have to assume that they are monitoring you, they're surveilling you, and they're going to be trying to listen in on your calls. And, you know, a country like Ukraine, high threat environment from an intelligence perspective, guys like Sondland, the members of the embassy staff, they will have been briefed extensively on the threats that exist in this region. They will have gotten briefings on the outset of their hiring, and then odds are they would even get a security briefing before they would go into the country about the various threats that existed. So either one of three things happened. Either one, he never got the briefing. That's bad. Two, he got the briefing and he forgot about it. That's bad. Or number three, he got the briefing, understood it, but doesn't care. And really, none of those answers is very positive.
So there is clearly a security protocol for these kind of communications. Today, compared with other administrations you've seen, Larry, how does the Trump administration comply generally with these security measures?
Some of the anecdotes we're hearing, like this one, you know, suggest that there are players who don't take security as seriously as they should. Now, in fairness to these individuals, I worked in the White House during the Obama administration. And when you have an administration, you have a mix of people. You've got people who spend, you know, decades in the business. You come steeped in this kind of knowledge. But you also have people who come from the corporate world. You have people that come from academia, people that come from politics, from the campaign. And they come in and they're given jobs, they're given clearances, they're given access to sensitive information. They all get briefed on, you know, that first week, they get flooded with all kinds of briefings about all the different rules and regulations. But at the same time they're getting those briefings, they're also starting to go 180 miles an hour to accomplish the foreign policy objectives of the president. We had one individual lose his BlackBerry in China, and they called us, and their concern wasn't that they lost a BlackBerry in China. Their concern was, my boss needs his BlackBerry, a new BlackBerry. Can you get me one? And you know, my concern was, oh, my God, you've lost a BlackBerry in China. He called me back 5 minutes later to say, oh, don't worry. Hey, everything's fine. The Chinese found it and they just gave it back to us. I said they need to put it in a lead-lined box and mail that sucker back to Washington to be examined forensically. And my assumption, again, is if you know, your device falls into the hands of a foreign government, you have to assume that it's been compromised.
How do you think this phone call plays into the Democrats' larger case against Trump?
If it plays out as it's been characterized, it suggests a greater hand by the president on the tiller of this scheme here. And so that, you know, that begins to feed into some of these impeachment charges, I think.
That was security analyst Larry Pfeiffer, who spent more than three decades working in U.S. intelligence. He now directs the Hayden Center for Intelligence, Policy, and International Security at George Mason University. It is a sad week in Washington. Bebe the panda is leaving the National Zoo and heading home to China. For decades, Beijing has been dispatching its pandas like ambassadors on loan. They may be the country's cutest peacemakers, but just how influential is panda diplomacy? The world's Lucy Martirosian takes a look.
America watched Bebe grow up.
They have seen every moment of his life on the panda camps.
Lungs sound good and clear.
Brandy Smith is the deputy director at the National Zoo in Washington. That's where Bebe lives and where the panda cam broadcasts his life 24/7. Smith says people got to watch Bebe chomp on his first bamboo shoot, try a sweet potato, and take his first tumble in the grass. But now, Bebe is leaving the zoo and going to China.
I get sadder as the time gets closer, you know, especially now we're going back, looking at his baby pictures, you know, just spending time with him.
Smith and her colleagues have always known this day was coming.
We have been preparing for this since the moment that he was born.
He's part of a giant panda loan agreement that China has with zoos all around the world. Any panda cub remains property of China no matter where it's born. Once the panda turns 4, it's sent to a research center in Chengdu for breeding. Pandas were endangered, but are now classified as vulnerable. China started using pandas as goodwill ambassadors in the 1950s. Think of it as China's soft and cuddly power. It sent 2 pandas to the U.S. in 1972, right after President Richard Nixon's historic visit to China. First Lady Pat Nixon welcomed the first pair, Ling Ling and Sing Sing, to the National Zoo.
And I think pandemonium is going to break out right here at the zoo. Thank you very much.
Since then, China has bestowed pandas on some other favored nations.
Nämlich die beiden Panda-Bären und ich denke,
Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel called the 2 pandas great diplomats. So did Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
The panda is a symbol of peace and friendship, which is fitting, considering Canada's ever-growing relationship with China.
There's speculation that China also uses pandas to signal disapproval. Back in 2010, China took back 2 pandas from American zoos right after President Barack Obama met with the exiled Tibetan spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. Right now, the U.S. and China don't have the best relationship. There's the ongoing trade war and U.S. criticism of China's persecution of ethnic Uyghurs. So is it possible that Bebe's return to China has anything to do with that?
No, absolutely not. That's not a true statement.
That's Brandy Smith at the Washington Zoo again.
As part of our contract, the cubs go to China at the age of 4 so that they can be part of the breeding program there.
From her perspective, panda diplomacy means something more than politics and international relations.
I think of panda diplomacy maybe on a smaller scale. We have been so incredibly fortunate to work with these giant pandas and to work with our colleagues in China on caring for them, on saving an endangered species.
But she says you need people to care about them. And right now, millions of people have been watching Bebe in the zoo or on the panda cam.
They see these pandas. They feel awe. They feel inspiration. They feel excitement, happiness. They fall in love with these pandas. And they say, what can I do to help save this species?
Tomorrow, Bebe the panda will leave the Washington spotlight. He'll be flying out in a crate in his own private FedEx plane on a nonstop flight to China. For The World, I'm Lucy Martirosian.
You're listening to The World. A Syrian filmmaker in Aleppo and her doctor husband built a hospital during the war there. They lived in it, and she filmed their life.
My fears of being killed, that's one of the things which kept me, like, just filming every day.
The documentary For Sama is a diary for their 2-year-old daughter. Someday, they hope, she'll understand. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. The impeachment inquiry of President Trump took an unexpected turn today. Congressional investigators are now looking into whether Trump may have lied to Robert Mueller in written answers that he was asked to provide for Mueller's probe into Russian election meddling. Bottom line, it could be another ground for impeachment. As far as the Ukraine investigation goes and the main line of questioning this week in Washington, Jennifer Williams, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence, appears before the House Intelligence Committee tomorrow, and Trump, not a huge surprise, is tweeting about her. Yesterday, the president called Williams a never-Trumper, an unfounded accusation. Louis Lukens was the chargé d'affaires in London and was Jennifer Williams' boss. He worked closely with her for nearly 3 years.
She's a terrific Foreign Service officer. I couldn't tell you her political leanings. All of us in the Foreign Service don't really talk about our political leanings. You know, she's had some tough jobs in her career. She worked on Syrian refugee issues for a while. She served in Lebanon. This is someone who, since she joined the Foreign Service, has been committed to our national security and supporting American businesses and American people overseas.
So when President Trump says Jennifer Williams is a never-Trumper, what do you make of that?
Well, look, I think the president is lashing out at anyone who he sees as a threat. There's no evidence at all that she's a never-Trumper. In fact, she cut her tour in London short to go back and work in the White House in the vice president's office to support the White House's agenda.
Jennifer Williams listened in to the now infamous July 25th phone call between Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. She told lawmakers in closed-door testimony that Trump's request for investigation struck her as unusual and inappropriate. Those were her words. And also, quote, shed some light on possible other motivations, unquote, for the president's decision to freeze security aid to Ukraine. Williams is still employed by the State Department as part of their detail to Mike Pence's office. So do you think that was an especially brave move on her part to speak out this way?
Well, it was brave. And I have to say it was a little bit disheartening for me to see the lack of support that she's gotten from the vice president's office over the last couple of days and since the president's attack on her.
You're referring to the fact that Vice President Pence's office did not defend Williams after that Twitter attack from Trump.
Did not defend her and basically just said she's a State Department employee, which she is, but she's on detail to the vice president's office. And for all intents and purposes, she is a White House employee at this time.
So you're a former diplomat and ambassador. How unusual is that, not to defend their employee?
Well, it is unusual, and one would hope that they would defend her. But my sense is everyone sort of runs scared of the president and doesn't want to be the target of the next tweet. So people are taking a hands-off approach to this. But it's disappointing to see for someone who, you know, London is a very sought-after posting in the Foreign Service, and she left early to go back and work for the vice president's office to support the White House agenda.
On that point, I mean, would Pence's office have chosen Williams among a list of possible candidates for the slot?
She would have thrown her name in the hat and she would have gone through an interview process and would have been selected by not necessarily the vice president himself, but certainly by the vice president's national security advisor would have made that decision.
And at that point, can they vet a candidate by trying to find out anything about their political leanings?
I suppose they might informally. I mean, it would be very inappropriate to do so. And employees from across the government work on detail to the White House, whether the National Security Staff or the Vice President's office. And I spent a year at the National Security Council during the George W. Bush presidency, and we had employees from the Pentagon, the CIA, Treasury, State Department, and none of us were ever vetted to see what our political leanings were.
I got to say, Jennifer Williams' story seems to be another case of the State Department getting their legitimacy taken out from under them. What are you hearing from your former colleagues at the State Department about how this hollowing out at the Department of State could affect it in the long term?
First and foremost, what I'm hearing is a real sense of disappointment at the Secretary of State's inability or unwillingness to support his troops. And a lot of Foreign Service officers have been on the stand in the last couple of weeks at some personal risk. And there's been just absolutely resounding silence from Mike Pompeo's office.
Louis Lukens was the chargé d'affaires in London at the U.S. Embassy there and oversaw the work of Jennifer Williams. Williams is currently a special advisor to Vice President Pence for Europe and Russia. Tomorrow, she will testify in the impeachment inquiry. Louis Lukens, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Three other key witnesses also appear before Congress tomorrow: Kurt Volker, Tim Morrison, and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. If you're playing impeachment bingo, you'll be in luck if you have the square Rudy Giuliani. He's going to come up a lot. It's been quite a path for Giuliani, from the unifying New York mayor after the September 11th attacks to Trump's personal lawyer and the center of the impeachment scandal. Andrea Bernstein co-hosts a Trump Inc. podcast from WNYC and ProPublica. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. So Rudy Giuliani, we remember, was America's mayor as head of New York City. It was a very local story. So how and when did that shift go from a New York City focus to Giuliani becoming this kind of international man of mystery, seemingly on behalf of Trump, the president?
So
Giuliani ran for president himself and did not do very well. This was in 2008. He lost to John McCain, and he was someone who was seeking political relevance. So when Trump ran in 2016, Giuliani became a major surrogate for Trump. And this put him back in the limelight. It got him all kinds of attention. And so far as we can tell, it also got him business. Giuliani, by talking about his relationship with Trump, seemed to attract quite a few clients, both domestic and international, including in the former Soviet Union and its satellite countries, places like Romania, and particularly Ukraine, where he's had business relationships that go back a decade.
I mean, when you say Rudy Giuliani was doing business, what was that business?
So it's a bit of a mystery to us. I mean, what's clear is that he was going around the world making speeches. What he seemed to be selling first was proximity to him and to his image as this sort of tough law and order guy. At the time that he began to work for Trump as a part of his legal team, and I should stress that Rudy Giuliani was an unpaid lawyer. But by going on television, by really almost setting up an office at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, he made it very clear that you could get to Trump through him. And he seemed to start picking up clients who wanted that access.
So now Giuliani himself is under federal investigation, and that goes back to his ties to two businessmen, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. And they've got pretty deep ties to Ukraine. What questions are prosecutors trying to answer in relation to Giuliani right now?
Well, I think there's a sort of a few things that are going on. First of all, the background of these gentlemen is that they are both entrepreneurs from the former Soviet Union who very suddenly, right around the time Trump was elected president, also became major political donors in the United States. They connected with Rudy Giuliani in his attempt to get the Ukrainians to investigate Joe Biden. So they were helping Rudy Giuliani with that. They were making contributions to Trump political causes. There are these series of mind-bendingly, eye-crossingly complicated business relationships between Rudy Giuliani and these two men who were indicted in the Southern District of New York. What were they charged with doing? They were charged with making contributions in excess of the limits on behalf of an unnamed Ukrainian national, and also, in a separate instance, funneling money from an unnamed Russian national into the U.S. finance system. So all of this is very much against the law. And as we know, they have been very, very tightly tied with Rudy Giuliani through these series of business relationships. One thing is clear. There was a brew of business and political interests that were at play that were not necessarily in the U.S. national interest.
With a federal investigation and with all these shady connections, Giuliani would seem to be a liability for Trump right now. There is a White House counsel. Why does the president even need Rudy Giuliani?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. So the White House counsel represents the White House, the institution. And Rudy Giuliani represents President Trump, the man. Now, Giuliani is not filing court briefs. He's not standing up in court. He is representing Trump in the sense that he's sort of representing him on television and in the world of public opinion. I think it's hard to exactly understand all of Trump's personnel decisions. Trump certainly goes by gut instinct, and he feels that Rudy Giuliani is helping him and has helped him. And there's no indication that he sees otherwise. Now, Trump and Rudy Giuliani really seem to have a worldview that feeds off each other. They are in deep on these unsubstantiated conspiracy theories, and Giuliani has been empowered to go around the world, then fan the flames of them. And that seems to be something that is making Donald Trump very, very happy right now.
Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast from WNYC and ProPublica, and author of the forthcoming American Oligarchs, The Kushners of Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. Andrea, great to have you with us today. Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
For years now, the Chinese government has been detaining hundreds of thousands of Uyghur Muslims in re-education camps in far western China. This was widely known, but this weekend, leaked documents obtained by the New York Times showed the chilling details of the policy. It's one of the most significant leaks of Chinese government papers in decades. Furkat Jawdat is a Uyghur Muslim living in Virginia, where he works as a software engineer. His mother was detained in China last year. Jawdat says he was too afraid to speak out, but last spring, that changed.
So my mom was detained last year, February 2018. I waited for her to be released more than 7 months. And then from last year, September, I started speaking out because that's about the time that first former detainees, they start to be released, and then they spoke out about their experience in those camps. And then every time when I hear their testimonies, like, I just couldn't sleep, and then I just think about my mom, and then especially because of her health condition even before she was detained, I just couldn't take it anymore, so I decided to speak out.
So when did you actually last see your mother?
Last time was on 2010, September.
Wow.
When I was going to the university before I came to the U.S.
I mean, you do speak with your mom occasionally on the phone, and I know you've said in the past that you believe Chinese authorities are forcing your mother to tell you that everything is fine in China, she's being treated well, and for you to stop your activism. Why do you think that's the case? What evidence do you have?
So I got a phone call from her, and I wasn't, like, I couldn't believe myself that I was talking to my mom on the phone. And I asked her a couple of times, that, Mom, is that really you? Like, is that you? Hmm. And then as soon as, like, as we talked a couple minutes in the beginning, and I asked her, like, Mom, can I add my dad, my sisters, my brother on the line so we can just talk and then we can all know that, like, what's, like, how are you doing right now? And then she said that I have to talk to you first. So at that moment, I kind of realized that she wasn't alone. So after that, she just told me that, son, I know what you did. And then, like, I was in a school, like a really nice school, and then I was well taken care of. So you don't have to speak out anymore. Like, you cannot be part of any organizations doing anything against our country. And then everything is fine here. All those, like, propaganda stuff that I was listening many, many times, like, from different people. But I just couldn't believe that was coming from my mother's mouth.
So in March of this year, you had the opportunity to speak to the highest diplomat in the U.S. You met with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. What were you able to discuss?
So in the meeting, I was there with another three Uyghurs, and then we all have our family members in the camp, and then there was a girl. She was actually former detainee in those camps, and then we spoke about how the camp condition is and then what's happening inside the camp, and especially like how it's even affecting our lives and then our families here in the U.S., and then we asked the U.S. government to stand up and then ask the Chinese government to shut down those camps and especially release, help us to release our family members from those places.
So what would you like to see Washington doing?
The number one thing is there is a bill in the Congress, the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act of 2019. And then it's been sitting on the House for almost a year right now. And then we are pushing all the representatives to become sponsors and then get it passed and become a law. So that's the main important thing. And then another one is the Magnitsky Act to sanction the Chinese government officials who got directly or indirectly involved in those crimes.
Have you felt harassed since you've been outside of China?
Not directly from anyone close to me, but all the time from the Chinese police or the government through my mother or through WeChat from the Chinese police or the agents.
Recently, the official information arm of the Chinese government labeled you a terrorist. I mean, that's in China, but I mean, how does that make you feel being labeled that way?
So from a, like, China, like, as the second largest superpower in the world, to getting labeled as a terrorist, it is a huge title that I never expected to have. So the threats before that was coming from inside of China, from the Chinese agents in the region. But after that statement was released, and it was published on all over the media, especially the Chinese media, so I don't know what will be the future of my family, especially my mother, in their hands. But especially after all those statements, all those news, I don't know if I can still feel safe anywhere I go.
Firkat Jawdat is a Uyghur activist. He's been speaking with us from London. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you live in a war zone, you're hearing guns, bombs, you're seeing atrocities. You also somehow have to go to work every day, care for your family, try to be normal in a situation that is anything but. That's part of the story our next guest can tell. One of them is a filmmaker who used her video camera to chronicle years of daily life under bombardment in the Syrian city of Aleppo. The star of the film is her baby daughter, Sama. She sings to Sama as the film begins. After the singing, you heard an explosion in a hospital in Aleppo. My guest, filmmaker Wad Al-Khatib, and her husband, Dr. Hamza Al-Khatib, a medical doctor, didn't just work in that hospital. They built it and they lived there. Tell us about that scene we just heard there, Wad. What was happening?
So it was just like normal day when I was sitting with my baby, like in the room, playing together. And you start like hear the aircrafts flying over and then they start the explosion.
Immerse us deeper in the city of Aleppo in this time. What does it look like when all these attacks are happening?
It looks like very beautiful city, whatever happened. But with all of this beauty and the people who were just trying to stay alive every day. There was more than 300,000 people who were living in besieged city. The hospitals were target, the civil defense center were target, schools were target, normal people places were target. So just like struggle to stay alive, struggle to challenge the regime, the Russian who were bombing this area, and keep your life normal as much as you can.
So tell me about that daily life. Like, what do you do for food? Where do you get money? Where did you get diapers?
So before the siege was like everything was available because of the trade between Turkey and Syria. So you can find everything you want in Aleppo, like any kind of fruit or food. But then when the siege happened and the Assad regime and Russian forces, they controlled the whole entrance for east part of Aleppo. All the fruit, the vegetables, anything fresh, you can't find it.
There's that incredible scene where one of the women in the house that you're focused on gets a persimmon.
Yeah.
And it's like she's just received a diamond.
Exactly.
It's incredible. Hamza, you ran the hospital that we were just talking about. I mean, for you as a doctor and a new father, what was your daily routine like? And how hard was it for you to balance kind of the atrocities you had to deal with in the hospital? You said 6,000 patients came through while you were there. And meantime, Sama, your daughter, not to mention Wad, your wife, are exposed upstairs to the shelling and the bombs.
I can't, like, understand really, like, mentally how we got through all of this. But you feel like you have to do what you have to do. You know, like, when there is a massacre, I can't think about anything else. Just, like, focusing on the casualties at the moment. We know that we are the target of the Russian and the Syrian regime. Like, everyone in Aleppo knew that. Even some patients were refusing to be admitted at the hospital. Like, even if they need, like, to be operated. Like, when they awake, they're just like, take us out of here, please.
They knew would be targeted.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, our chance is better if we are at home or even close to the front line, because we know that the regime and the Russian will target the hospital.
Throughout all this tension and misery in the film, there are scenes of really joyful moments. There's a flashback to the day you actually set up the hospital and your friends are really energized and they're laughing, they're happy. What was that day like?
So Hamza and his friends, the other doctor and some nurses, they decided like they need to set up a place where people need to know where is the hospital. And for me, I was like not responsible for anything. I was just like going around filming them what they were trying to do.
You filmed everything. I mean, you had 500 hours of videotape for this documentary.
Yeah, for me it was like really something I need to do, because I'm seeing them doing this great, amazing job and work.
I'm speaking with Wad Al-Khatib and her husband, Dr. Hamza Al-Khatib. Wad is the director of the new Frontline documentary for Sama. There's another joyful moment, of course, when you become a couple, you get married. We see your wedding. You dance to that old American country tune, Crazy. It's not Patsy Cline. But I don't know, what was that day like?
That was one of the craziest day in our life.
You're both smiling now. I mean, so it's fond memories. But
we're happy. We remember that day, and I can't be, like, happy enough. We really tried our best to find a way of, like, stay alive in that area. And one of that was, like, the wedding, a small wedding with, like, 15 of our friends. I borrow one dress from my friend. She was just married, like, 3 months before that. And, like, very simple wedding of just people trying to be happy.
One thing about your film that was kind of a revelation to me was just the determination of people like you, Wad, and Hamza to stay in Aleppo, to not leave.
Basically, it became like an act of resilience. The Russian and the regime didn't, like, want to, like, break the armed opposition. They want to break the people's will. So, like, everyone who's living there knew that, like, this is my act of resilience, that I'm living here. Like, I'll fix, like, even, like, the car, like, mechanics or something. Like, hey, I'm helping everyone to stay here because I'm repairing their cars.
But for many reasons, like, Hamza is a doctor, and any doctor and any person there will make difference in this situation. I had the camera. I have a lot of responsibility to continue filming these people. People who we lived with for 5 years, who we struggled together in many, many different situation.
There are so many families, thousands of families. So we decided we'll be part of this community, and as a family, we'll be there together.
عم بيدو روحه ولا أم المبسوطين شربوا مي قالوا حي.
At the end of the day, Wad, this film is a letter of sorts from you to your daughter Sama. It is titled For Sama. You say at times in the film that you feel terrible for the world that you brought her into. How do you think she will react when she's old enough to really absorb what you're telling her in this movie?
I'm really trying not to put any expectation about this. I will keep her, like, free to express anything she will feel. I need to let Sama watch it every 2-3 years, how she will see that when she will be, like, 15 or 20 or 25. So I'm so interesting to hear from her.
I have to say, this is a beautiful film, but it's also a film that is very hard to watch.
I think when you see it in cinema with a lot of people, it'd be like a group experience.
This is one of the recommendation for everyone, really. Like, don't watch it alone.
Wad and Hamza Al-Khatib, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
For Sama airs tomorrow night on PBS Frontline. You can also watch it online at pbs.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.